This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello from Stephen Crittenden. This is the Religion Report.
Bir cılız dere akardı Cudi Dağı'ndan aşağı. Dere başı köyümdü benim, iki yanı bahçe. Bahçelerin varı yoğu, sarı armut, kırmızı nardı.
That's the voice of the former Prime Minister of Turkey, Bülent Ecevit, reading his own poetry from a recording he presented to me himself when I interviewed him in the early 1990s. Bülent Ecevit was Prime Minister of Turkey 5 times, a much admired figure, and very gracious to me on a day when I arrived at his office so ill I could barely speak. He died last week after a stroke that left him in a coma for 6 months. He wrote poetry about Gallipoli, loved Australians, and always wanted to come here. I did my best to bring him to Australia for the Deakin Lectures in 2001 to give a lecture on what Gallipoli means to the Turks. It would have been a very moving affair, but he was unable to come. Bülent Ecevit was a staunch defender of secularism in Turkey. Here's a moment from my interview with him.
Before mid-80s, that is before the end of the Cold War and the bipolar world, Turkey had a great security value for the West. And the West seemed to be happy that Turkey was anxious to become part of the Western European community of nations. But since the end of the bipolar world, Europe and the West in general does not need Turkey in the West as before. And I get the impression, and this impression is shared by many people in Turkey in recent years, that the West has been pushing Turkey into the position of an exclusively Middle Eastern country. Turkey's geopolitical position is a very complex one. We are at the same time a Middle Eastern country, a Balkan country, an Asiatic country, and a European country. Yet the strongest imprint on the Turkish mind comes from Western Europe.
Bülent Ecevit, the former Prime Minister of Turkey, who died last week. Well, our major interview on today's program is with visiting American Franciscan Richard Rohr, OFM. OFM stands for Order of Friars Minor, and they're one of 3 or 4 different branches of the religious movement founded by St. Francis of Assisi. Richard Rohr is a well-known figure in American Catholic circles, very much in the tradition of the famous post-war Catholic monk Thomas Merton. He was born in Kansas, has been active in the civil rights movement, and writes for the American magazine Sojourners and for the National Catholic Reporter. He founded a famous retreat center in Albuquerque, New Mexico, the Center for Action and Contemplation, and he's on a speaking tour of Australia at the moment. I caught up with him last week. Richard Rohr, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I remember as a child that Bugs Bunny always seemed to be heading for Albuquerque. Was he heading for a Franciscan retreat center?
Took a left turn in Albuquerque. That's right. Yeah, it's amazing how that one line got remembered. Well, we haven't seen him in the region, but I know the myth. Yeah.
Can we talk about the Center for Action and Contemplation in Albuquerque? What goes on there?
Well, we're about 20 years old now. I founded it 20 years ago because I wanted to establish a place which could give good spirituality, in-depth formation to people who are working for the poor, for social change, and that's what it's become. So we have people who come from really all over the English-speaking world for our internship program where we take them down to the border of Mexico and live with the poor. But in the context of all that, we're teaching them a contemplative life. So it's putting together what appear to be the great big polar opposites. They're really not, but they appear to be. Action and contemplation.
I guess you tend to associate the Franciscan tradition with action, with people in sandals wandering through the world, don't you?
Probably so. And yet that has been a tension since Francis himself. Of, you know, he went off to the cave just like Jesus went off to the desert. Then after he would find his message there, he would go back to the streets. So ideally, the Franciscan life was very much a cycle, a spiral between the world of solitude, silence, and the city.
Of course, this is a great part of the United States where the Franciscans have hundreds and hundreds of years of history, don't they?
Well, in fact, where we are at, we are the oldest Franciscan missions. They first came up the Rio Grande from Mexico. This is 100 years before the California missions or the Texas missions. It was first New Mexico where we came almost 400 years ago. That's right.
Is that a history that the Franciscans feel that they have to apologize about? You know, in the 90s and the 80s, there was a lot of that kind of thing, or is it regarded in New Mexico as a positive history?
I would say there are certainly the mixed elements. But in general, like our native peoples would all call themselves, I'm Catholic and I'm native at the same time. The Franciscans who came to New Mexico were, in general, very broad-minded, and they did not make the native peoples reject their native religion. There were a few exceptions to that, but for the most part, not. And that has worked very much in their favor because it gave them a foot in both camps, in Western culture and Christianity, and yet a rootedness in their own native spirituality. So I think it's fair to say there's sort of still a romantic attachment to the brown-robed friar as being the padrecito, the little father who took care of the people.
It seems to me that centres like yours have picked up a lot on Buddhist New Age retreat centres that we associate with California, for example, that they're offering people something that they seem to want that comes out of monasteries, that involves retreats and something temporary.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, but what's being called Buddhism, I as a Franciscan know, was taught by my own 13th, 14th century Franciscan mystics. But here's the difference, is we didn't have the sophisticated, refined psychological vocabulary in the 13th and 14th century that Buddhists have now. So very often, Christians will find themselves drawing from Buddhist sources simply, in my opinion, because the refined vocabulary of what is happening to the ego, to the self, how does transformation happen, is very often, their vocabulary is very often very helpful, even though I know it's identical in substance to what our own Christian mystics taught. So it's a coming together that is, I think, to the advantage of all.
You're part of the 800-year tradition of St. Francis and St. Bonaventure, but are you also in the sort of American feel-good New Age guru tradition? You know, is there part of the Oprah Winfrey and Dr. Phil in what you're doing?
Well, in the sense that I'm trying to find a language and metaphors that make sense to the present consciousness. If you want to call that New Age, I don't think it is. I think it's the gospel. Paul himself took upon himself to be all things to all people. And I think that's our task too. But whenever you do that, even John's gospel that uses a philosophical word like logos, I mean, are we going to accuse him of being overly trendy because he found a language that the contemporary people could hear? I don't think so, you know, but that's an umbrella word, like New Age is an umbrella word that Christians apply today to almost anything they don't understand, and they don't realize that some of the things they don't understand are their own tradition.
One and one half wandering Jews, free to wander wherever they choose, are traveling together in the Sangre de Cristo, Blood of Christ mountains of New Mexico. On the last leg of a journey they started a long time ago, the arc of a love affair, rainbows in the high desert air, mountain passes slipping into snow, hearts and bones, hearts and bones, hearts and bones.
On ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and online, this is the Religion Report, and we're celebrating New Mexico with Paul Simon, Stephen Crittenden, and Richard Rohr OFM. Richard Rohr got some flack from readers of his column in the National Catholic Reporter recently when he suggested that few transformations happen in church, that the places where real transformation happens in our world are Alcoholics Anonymous, Ground Zero, the Cancer Ward, and of course the mountains of New Mexico.
Mountain passes slipping into storm.
Well, I did say that. I wrote a whole Lenten series on the concept of liminal space, liminality. It's amazing how interesting that subject has become to people. But in that, I said, are the typical Catholic liturgies liminal space? Do they pull you out of business as usual into an alternative universe where you have a different frame of reference, which Jesus would call the kingdom of God? And I have to say, it's overwhelmingly obvious that they don't. They're very much a confirmation of the present consciousness, of the present politics, of the present self-serving worldview. And I've often said, I go to Switzerland, God looks like a banker. I go to Germany, God looks like a policeman. I go to America, God looks like a businessman. I don't know yet what he looks like in Australia, but it's so obvious to me that we're not leading people into alternative, transcendent experience. But for the most part, largely affirming and confirming, I mean, talk about feel good. We've been the people in the church into feel good in terms of making people think that American politics and wars are wonderful. I mean, only today are we finally waking up to what a tragedy this war has been.
You're talking there clearly about more than just dead liturgy, aren't you?
Well, really, a whole consciousness, that's right. The whole understanding of priesthood itself, which has so aligned itself with power, money, control. And I'm not saying that in an angry or malicious way, but it's just to join the clergy is to join an establishment worldview of status and security. And I think that's what my father, St. Francis, was trying to oppose. When I joined the friars, first of all, we were not encouraged to become priests. You know, Francis himself was not a priest. He refused ordination. And then they said, if you are going to accept ordination, at best, we're blue-collar priests. I don't know, do you use that expression over here? Yeah. We're not white-collar priests. Our job is to live on the edge of the inside so we can lead people into the larger world of the gospel instead of mere churchianity. And churchianity has far too often, and I think I'm being fair, become a substitute for Christianity.
We often hear secularization accused as part of the reason, the big reason for the collapse of church going and so on, that there's a failure going on in the outside world with all its false allures and so on. But it often occurs to me that perhaps a big part of the failure has been a failure of imagination on the part of the church and its leaders, and that's what it sounds to me like you're talking about.
Yeah, I think so. When religion doesn't move to what I'm going to call the mystical level, now don't let that be a too far out word. As far as I'm concerned, mysticism simply means when you move beyond external belief systems to inner experience, where you know something, you've experienced a love and a life and a quality of being that we would call God for yourself. When religion doesn't move to the mystical level, almost always the substitute for mysticism is morality. It gives the ego a sense of boundariedness, of superiority, of control, of earning God's love. In fact, I'd say the more you become preoccupied with moral minutiae or
doctrine, perhaps.
Well, that's what I mean by external belief systems. When it remains at the external level of belief systems and rituals, to the degree you're preoccupied with that, it's almost a litmus test of how little you've experienced the real.
As a sociologist friend of mine says, doctrine is death.
When that's all you have. When you don't know, you have to pretend that you do know. When you don't really know the goodness of God, when you haven't really experienced mercy, forgiveness, the generosity of God, you have to bolster it up with all kind of heroic affirmations about the nature of God, and you can tell it doesn't mean very much.
Richard, we keep coming back to the Franciscans, but it often strikes me that the greatest of all of the Catholic Church's glories is in its orders, its religious orders. This last 20 years or so has been, under John Paul, has been a period of marginalisation of the grand old Catholic religious orders, who had hundreds of years of tradition behind them, who are the people who spread the gospel all over the world, after all. They did the heavy lifting in the early centuries. And there has been a failure to plumb the depths, to go back to the great traditions, spiritual traditions of those individual orders, the Carmelites, the Franciscans, the Benedictines.
You know, it's funny, my last printed article in the States in mid-October was in America, the Jesuit magazine, and they asked me to write an article on the future of religious life. Already I've received such interesting and, I think, overwhelmingly supportive response to it. But among the things I said there, I think religious life historically served as what I'm going to call the global positioning satellites for a culture and power-bound church. You know, we were always not really under the pyramid of hierarchy. We were the little satellites out on the edge, spiritual hothouses. We always say the reformers come from the religious orders, and the heretics, if you will, because we're not trained to be company men. We're trained in the charism of the gospel of our particular order. And when you're formed in that, we see this in the women religious, too. You look back at many of the preoccupations of the pyramid, just to use that for want of a better word, and so often they're not the concerns of Jesus. In fact, very often the concerns have to do with something Jesus never talked about once or showed any concern in. So I think religious life keeps us rooted in gospel much more than churchiness. And I'm not making an either-or distinction. I'm a man of the church, you know. But I toast, as Newman said, the gospel first, or my conscience first, you know, and later the church. And far too often we've allowed church to become, I'm afraid, pure idolatry.
Well, I mean, you say somewhere, and I suspect this is one of your constant messages, that Jesus didn't come to found a tribe. What you're really saying is he didn't come to found a church.
I think Jesus brought a message that is necessary, and this is becoming very obvious with religion right now in the world. He brought a message that is necessary for the reform of every religion. And once we became a competing religion ourselves, the irony is we could not communicate the message because we became a form of empire. And once you're into imperial thinking, Roman Empire, I mean, we took over a lot of its vocabulary and worldview after 313, after Constantine. Once you have an imperial worldview, you can't let the Sermon on the Mount be meaningful to you. You can't allow the eight Beatitudes to have any real practical significance, because they're non-supportive of empire and imperial worldviews. So I think you're right. We have to somehow say it from a different base and from a different perspective.
And yet, if you go back to the world that Jesus set out to transform, maybe we're living in that world. Maybe there's some sort of deep social, cultural Christianity that even if sort of church going's on the decline, people unconsciously, perhaps, live by the parables, live by gospel values to a far greater extent than the anxious church is ever willing to concede.
As far as I'm concerned, secularism is a child of Christianity. The incarnation, which is our great trump card, that God entered the material world and took on the form of the human, right? That sets the stage for what we now call secularism.
The implication being that the material world is good.
That's right. That this is the locus, the hiding place of God and the revealing place of God. Now, after saying that, I'd be the first to say that you can get trapped inside of secularism with any loss of transcendence, with any loss of true wholeness, the big picture, the whole picture, which Jesus would call the reign of God. But I still agree with you that at its core, secularism is our child. We created it, and now, just as you said, I mean, I meet scientists. I'm working a lot with the convergence between religion and science. I meet scientists who are much more humble before mystery, much more willing to work with mystery and in awe of mystery and in love with mystery than most clergymen I know. And many of these scientists would call themselves secular in various forms. But they're very generative people for the life of the world, for the sickness of the world, for the health of God's people, much more than many of us religious and clergy who simply are preoccupied with self-maintenance and self-protection. And the world is starting to see this, that just because you wear the shingle Christian, it doesn't really mean you're a generative person, a life-giving person, which in terms of the fruits of the Spirit are the real indicators of whether the Spirit is operating in you, through you, with you. I think that's the impasse that managed religion is coming to, that it realized, or it's starting to realize, or the world's starting to realize, that we thought we could manage the nature of love. We could decide and compartmentalize who gets the love and who doesn't get the love. And that's not the very nature of love. Love cannot be managed. Certainly not God's love. And the silliness of religion, when it thinks it can do that, is becoming rather obvious.
Tell me about one of the themes you're speaking a lot about here in Australia, which is dualistic thinking.
Well, I'm convinced that Jesus was the first non-dual teacher in the West. The East had a lot more of them. And that's revealed in lines like, "My Father's sun shines on the good and the bad. His rain falls on the just and the unjust." You cannot make dogma out of that. You cannot make any exclusionary system whatsoever out of that. So those kind of quotes, and they're rather frequent in Jesus, are largely ignored by the institution. They're not quoted much in papal encyclicals because you can't do anything with it. It leaves the ego helpless, you see, before mystery, as it were.
Let's go back to what do we mean by dualistic thinking, us and them principally, is that right?
Yes, that the dual mind, which is the egoic operating system that we're all operating out of, knows by comparison, by differentiation, by distinction, and by separation. It says, "I am not that." It's a process of affirmation and denial, affirmation and denial, the classic Western debate, and the smarter person is supposed to win. Dual thinking is very good in the world of science, mathematics, ordinary logic of getting you through the day. But once you approach mystery, infinity, eternity, God, the great concepts like freedom, the dualistic mind falls utterly short. It can't deal with it. It can't know it. It divides the field. You see, dualistic thinking is inherently a self-canceling system. It always divides the field. What contemplation does, and contemplation is simply my word for non-dual thinking, where you pull back and get your own ego and fear and agenda out of the way, and you look at things as they are, not as you want them to be, not as you need them to be. It just is what it is, what it is. And you let that affront you and confront you. That's always a humiliation for the ego. So that's why people don't like to grow up into the contemplative mind or non-dual thinking, because it is experienced as a loss of control.
Perhaps the great heresies never quite ever go away. I don't know if you know the famous film The Third Man with Orson Welles. Of course, it's based on a novel by Graham Greene, and it's often been seen as really a book about the Jansenist heresy. And there's a great scene where they go into a library and there's a Jansenist crucifix with Jesus, instead of having his hands nailed to the cross outwardly to embrace the whole world, has them nailed above his head to symbolize that only the elect are saved. I wonder whether Jansenism, perhaps in the Catholic tradition, is the great example of the kind of dualistic thinking you're talking about.
Yes,
and maybe it never goes away.
It would be, because it's at heart the rejection of the incarnation. And once, as I said, we lose the mystery of incarnation, we've basically lost our only trump card. That's what's unique about the Christian religion. But it is such a humiliation to believe that Jesus had a penis, that we're dealing with an embodied God. The body, I'm convinced, the more I work in healing ministry, the body carries our shame. The body carries our sense of guilt and unworthiness. So you'll see, as you just said, in every century, there's this desire to compartmentalize, rid ourselves of embodiment and materialism. And it takes endless forms. I think that would be a very clear example of the dualistic mind. It splits.
Let me just finally give another example, sort of from the opposite side of the ledger. There's a great term called universalism. Mm-hmm. And I guess in at base it's the idea that in the end, no one's in hell. Everyone's going to heaven. The crucifixion ultimately saved everyone, and God's mercy will gather everyone. According to some theologians, even Judas and Satan in the end will be saved. Often hearing John Paul II, I thought to myself, actually, at base, he's a universalist. Some of the things Benedict has written suggest the same. I think the vast majority, probably, of Australian Catholics these days are universalists.
In effect. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In effect.
Yeah. Well, you know...
Which doesn't mean they know they're going to heaven.
No.
But they hope that everybody, including the Buddhists and the Hindus and the Jews and the Muslims, everybody will be saved.
Isn't that a marvelous act of trust in the mercy and victory of God? If we say God is victorious, what else would God's victory be? Is God so small that God's victory can only win over a few? I think that's the sad commentary on much of Christian history. But the wonderful thing is that we find a constant subtext, starting in the scriptures themselves, starting in Isaiah, of language of all, of language of everybody. It's called apokatastasis in Greek, which means universal restoration. It was believed by any number of the early fathers of the church, taught in various forms, subtle forms very often, but you can see that it was a hope. It was a desire, it was the yearning of the spirit that God's victory has to be this great and has to be this big. It's interesting that, like we in the Catholic Church, have officially proclaimed many people to be in heaven. We call them saints. We have never proclaimed a single person to be in hell. Now, that's rather telling. We never said, we are sure Hitler's in hell. We are sure Judas is in hell. We've never said that. That reveals something. And I think it's the hope planted in us by the Holy Spirit of the nature of God's love. If grace is true, we've got to take it to its logical conclusion. If you and I are loved in spite of ourselves, then what's the cutoff point of worthiness and unworthiness? Now, I admit, I have to receive that. I have to surrender to that. But I think God has led all of us to surrender in spite of ourselves. So for God to allow that, God to do that in death, after death, that's easy for me to trust.
I think any more at this point would be unfair. Thank you very much for being on the program.
You're welcome, Steve. Good to be with you. Thank you.
And whoa, 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 she said, why don't we drive through the night? We'll wake up down in Mexico.
Richard Rohr, and he's speaking in Brisbane tonight and in Perth over the weekend. Details on our website. And we'll be back to dualistic thinking on the Religion Report next week. In the meantime, thanks to Emma Hoff-Williams, Jenny Parsonage and John Diamond for production. I'm Stephen Crittenden. See you then.
He said, 'cause that's not the way the world is, baby. This is how I love you, baby. This is how I love you, baby. This is how I love you, baby.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.